Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
To Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a cold, chilly Super Bowl Sunday here in New York, and we're talking about a book today that is a historical novel. So when you read a Jane Austen novel or perhaps a sumptuous romance by the likes of the Bronte sisters, you don't really read too much about food. You don't see characters swooning over memorable dinners or tastes that are new and interesting. But that's okay. As many a fan of historical fiction may know, there is a new generation of great writers capturing the time and era of Victorian England and beyond through a modern perspective and looking back into the details, perhaps unburdened by many of the societal taboos, as many older writers may have been, and giving these characters from earlier times a new life. So my guest today is Martine Bailey, and she is the author of her latest book. It's called An Appetite for Violets, and she's on the phone right now from the UK. How are you, Martine?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks, Kathy.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, and congrats on your novel. It's lovely.
Thank you. And thank you.
So when I saw this book, at first I thought, okay, maybe it's a longtime historical fiction writer just kind of delving into the world of food for the first time. But then I learned that it was the other way around. So you're a cook, and you have what is exactly your experience? Because I know you've been a food writer, and you've written for many publications.
I'm an amateur cook who really kind of had two parallel interests, mm-hmm. in that I tended to enter cookery contests. That's how I got into it.
Wow.
And particularly with baking and foreign food, it was just something that grew on me, and I was lucky enough to win a merchant gourmet competition, and the prize was a cookery course in Provence in France. So that was a bit of a dream come true, and
wow.
And it really deepened my interest in French food. So I was doing that, and I was also, interested in writing,
mm-hmm.
but it took an encounter with some old recipes at a country house in England to give me a story, really.
Oh. Well, that's fascinating. One of the unique things about your novel is that our heroine, Biddy, she's a servant. So unlike a lot of the heroines, during this age that you're writing about, 18th century Europe, people didn't write, people generally wrote about the upper classes. But not only is she a servant, but she is an undercook at her master's home. What exactly is an undercook?
Well, there is another cook there, an older mm-hmm. woman, Mrs. Garland, who is in a way Biddy's mentor and advises her, really, because but Biddy's quite a feisty person, and she's very ambitious, and she is obsessed with cooking and learning about cooking.
Yeah.
So that's really where Biddy is at the start of the book. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's kind of thrust into it, but actually has a huge passion for cooking, and she dreams of one day, you know, getting married and opening her own tavern where she can cook. Is that
That's
a realist?
Right.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So I mean that was just a really quite modest ambition I felt, and obviously as a novelist I wanted to expose her to a lot more interest and adventures, really. So she gets caught up in a journey to Italy.
Yes. So this book it's really fun. It's not all about food. She ends up with a very interesting new mistress and ends up posing as her mistress at some points and getting into all sorts of trouble. So I don't want to give it away too much, but of course I haven't finished it yet, so I don't know if I could, but it's really lovely, and it is very gripping. So much, and there's a lot of humor too in these characters, from the perspective of Biddy, who is sort of caught in the middle of all this drama. So you mentioned she goes, she's, based in England, but she goes on a trip to Italy. And it seems that is where she really discovers that cooking, unlike in England, cooking has become a bit more of a skilled profession.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it fascinated me to look into the history of cookery and also try and, learn to do it. But, no, in fact, Britain at that time, although it had a good cuisine, I mean, better than I suppose we think it might have done, good pies, great roast beef, lots of puddings. It was famous for puddings. Biddy gets exposed to, much more interesting food once she crosses the channel. And, she kind of walks into this time in French food when, things like, the stocks and the bouillons were being developed great chefs were coming onto the scene. And also, the concept of restaurant
was just being
invented. So she sees that and, is being the character she is very excited by that. So everywhere, on the journey, because there's a map, as you've seen at the front of the book, she goes from France and then they cross this incredibly dangerous and quite frightening obstacle, which is the Alps, covered in snow, which were very frightening at the time. And passes into Italy and again, finds wonderful food. Yeah.
If I may, I wanted to read a charming passage about that that point in time in this book.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so she writes, this is coming from Biddy, so you write. No, I decided I would not stand over a roasting fire in the Italian heat to make the charred roast so famed in England. I wanted to try dainty Italian fare, and bought spicy bologna sausage, pink papery hams, hard white bread, and chalky cheeses. I also bought the makings of a macaroni pie I had seen made at an inn, and a new sort of green stuff named broccoli that proved a good deal tastier than cabbage.
Just
discovering other vegetables other than cabbage is really funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I mean, I had to read so much, and, I think what sometimes frustrated me is that although there are lots of fantastic diaries and letters written by travellers, they don't write enough about food. But occasionally someone would say, I tried this amazing thing called broccoli, and they'd spell it B-R-O-K-K-O-L-Y or something, And they couldn't believe that there were these other foods, because Britain was very much, meat and bread and cheese and pies. Yeah.
It sounds like you really had to dig deep to find these details. And it's good to know that broccoli has always been one of the most misspelled words. Since
that's
it still
true.
Is.
That's true. Yeah.
So interesting. So when, when she is discovering that Italy is quite ahead of the curve, at least from England, in creating, gastronomy, more of an art with food, that is. It seems to me, reading this, that a lot of the chefs are men, whereas she, you know, was thrust into being a cook like her master cook, who was also a woman. And it was just sort of like, it seems sort of like any old servant would be thrust into being the cook in England you know, just as they would be thrust into cleaning or whatever, something else.
Yeah.
It wasn't thought of.
I think probably not that dissimilar to recent times everywhere. You know, men tended to be more esteemed as cooks, particularly French cooks, but generally cooks. And men, when I looked at, you know, had to look at how much people were paid, men were paid a great deal more than women. So, in fact, you know, her ambitions really are quite high too. And even, you know, even towards the end of the book, you know, now I can't really give too much away, but she works with a man. So, because it really would have been very difficult at that, in that patriarchal society, really, to have got one of the top jobs.
Would have been highly unusual. And I guess, you know, a lot of us have seen Babette's Feast, and that was about an unusually talented and well-regarded French chef who was a woman. It seems like still, you know, in the professional world, cooking was a man's job, but in the home world, cooking was a woman's job.
And what fascinated me, though, was that there was a reaction against that, particularly in Britain, where women began to write cookery books. So I used, you know, quite a few. Mrs. Glass, Mrs. Raffold wrote books, and that really talked about the real food that, that was cooked in kitchens, and they became very popular. So there was a good reaction against that, and particularly against French cookery and against men
and all their haughtiness.
Yes.
So, yeah, and you capture this tradition of keeping sort of like home cookbooks, household books of recipes. And that's a theme throughout this book. Tell me more about those.
That was very much the inspiration for the book, that I was in a country house kitchen, a lovely old kitchen, and I saw the recipes, and they were obviously handwritten by a woman. And I just started from that journey and started to look at the archives and saw that when women got married, or particularly of a certain wealth, they were given a household book in which their, you know, mothers, servants, cooks would write advice and recipes or receipts, as they were called then. So they're all in different handwriting. They're a bit like a scrapbook. And I think that really was the concept that I wanted to have for Biddy, that she has this old household book called The Cook's Jewel, which is a common sort of name for that kind of, you know, beautiful book. And I think what really inspired me, Kathy, was that when you look at these books, they're really the first marks that you're going to find very often written by women, because women didn't write much at all. And sometimes you see very poignant things like handwriting practice. They're trying to write, you know, the first ever words, and they're about food. So that was very much the starting point for me, that women had tried to write these recipes as sort of gifts for other people to share
for their house.
Sort of women's community, really.
And and that's timeless too. I mean, who doesn't have like family scrapbooks of recipes from moms and grandmoms?
And I wanted to communicate that power that those old recipes have. You know, if you open your grandmother's cookery book or your mother's, and, you know, they're grease blotted, and there's something, you know, more than about how to make a dish in that. There's something that's you know, very special.
It's written with love. Thank you so much. I think you've done a great service by shining a light on this. You know, with all the food history that we know, it's especially of this time, you know, 17th, 18th century, it tends to be more of like the grand cuisine and things that would be recorded by brilliant people like Briat Severin,
yes,
and all those fancy foods. But this is actually real food that people were eating, and it was harder perhaps to track down, but you did it. So
thank you.
Yeah. So we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and we'll be chatting lots more.
You are listening to Lucky Seven by Mamarazzi.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hey, we're back chatting more with Martine Bailey, the author of An Appetite for Violets. So we were just talking about the tradition of household books of recipes. And throughout this novel, we have sprinkled in little entries written by our heroine, Biddy. And they're sort of like shorthand recipes. And we get to see a glimpse of those household books. You know, recipes like fig pie. Mm-hmm. Then there's macaroni pie, farcement pudding.
That's a bit more unusual.
Farcement.
At that point in the book, Biddy and her fellow travellers are crossing the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
So they're holed up in the snow trying to get over to Italy. And there's a wedding, and I'm always very interested in weddings and rites of passage like that, because food is, of course, you know, very much linked to that, and you know, special food. So that farcement pudding is, I think in the book it says something like, you know, it's made from the memories of old women.
It says, so, a dish for a wedding made from the memories of old women in the mountains of Savoy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's you know, potatoes and bacon and dried fruit and things.
Sounds very,
very
interesting.
Very big great pudding. So again one theme there is that those women who lived in the mountains, almost everything had to be preserved,
right?
Like,
okay,
a lot of food even in Britain, you know, so bacon and dried fruits,
currants. I see.
Yeah.
This is an interesting recipe.
Yeah, so I haven't actually eaten that, but I'm not sure if they still make it.
Well, I think it's really charming to read about these older recipes. And first of all, I love that they're just written. It's not like this formulaic list of ingredients with the exact measurement. It's just sort of a paragraph that describes what you do. And, you know, it's usually inspired by somebody else than, you know, some place in time that you tried it. So that's why these recipes are peppered with a little bit more than just instruction.
I love the fact that they're so fluid, really, in that they're not formulaic, just exactly as you say. I think they rely on the fact that people could cook and had learned
Definitely.
From watching other people. So they're almost like aid memoirs in a way.
Right. But,
and sometimes, you know, they're so vague. I made, you know, soul cakes is featured Soul? Early on for Soul Cakes, S-O-U-L.
Okay.
For an event called Souling, which was held on All Hallows Eve. And that's a very, very old recipe. And to be honest, looking at the recipe, you wouldn't know how to make it unless, you know, perhaps you were used to making biscuits and cakes a lot.
Okay.
So
it's
fascinating.
It assumed a certain experience or just a little bit of common sense know-how around the kitchen. But,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't very long ago that recipes all weren't written sort of in this memoir-like way.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it doesn't weaken our ability to just kind of think on our own feet in the kitchen more,
yeah.
That recipes are so exact.
Yeah. Yes, and I think we can be very fearful sometimes, can't we, that, you know, we're not getting it
quite
right.
Oh, my gosh,
right.
I did 2 tablespoons instead of,
yeah.
You know, 2
yeah.
teaspoons.
Oh, I know. I mean, you see it on websites, people saying, but can I use this different
right.
sort of salt? You know, you think, yes, of course, you can make it, you know, as you... very often, what I like, often they have names attached to those old
mm-hmm.
recipes, so it's, you know, Biddy's best method or, you know...
Right. Yeah.
It's which shows that, you know, there are lots of ways of making lots of wonderful things.
It is, and it's like relics too, because you get to find very interesting things like the preserved food tradition. That was pretty cool. Oh, and here's I was really fascinated, you know, going in this time 1700s, particularly France. You mentioned that it was like the time of the birth of the restaurant.
Yeah.
And as I recall, I did some digging into this topic for a book I wrote once, too.
Mm.
Most restaurants, and it's called restaurant because it means restore, that's a root word,
yes.
They were meant to have these medicinal effects to the food.
Yes, yeah.
So
yeah,
it wasn't
exactly.
just, yeah. So it was supposed to strengthen, so it was supposed to, it was a little alchemy-esque.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's what's amazing, isn't it, that... this thing, a restaurant, you know, this
mm-hmm.
this little cup of bouillon or whatever, has become something so amazingly
normal.
Popular and
normal.
And but I think the clever thing about it, and I'm sure we've read the same book on it, is that
the history of the restaurant.
You know, it was this idea about, you know, having a menu for the first time,
yes.
having a separate bill, and then you realise. Yes, before that, you were just sort of all sitting around a table.
Yep.
And
from
what I can gather from complaints people made, you know, if you arrived last and you just got the last bits, you were charged the same as the people who'd, you know, had the more select cuts. So, I must say, I thoroughly enjoyed all the research.
Yeah, and it led to a funny dinner that is recalled by Biddy. This is at a point where she's pretending that she is her mistress, and
yeah.
with a certain very interesting character named Mr. Loveday. Anyway, he is obsessed with having this viper stew because he believes... Yeah. It's going to promote his virility or something.
Yeah, I think, well, that's, I came across that as a true, you know, aphrodisiac or rejuvenator, which was, it's
Snake
horrible, isn't
stew.
It? To drown vipers in wine. And, you know, and then and that one I have to say, I haven't made and I would never make. But it's, you know, I mean, it's true. I mean, people were always, I think, you know, looking for ways to keep themselves young and virile.
Yeah, it seems like it was telling of this preoccupation of the raison d'etre of restaurants was really about trying to achieve certain things physically.
Yeah, yeah. But don't you think, you know, it just shows people have never changed.
Right. And I mean, it's so different from the goal of homemade food in the home kitchen, which is to nourish and sustain. Well,
that's right, to sustain and nourish,
rather than vipers.
And certainly, one thing sometimes when I read, you know, the bills of fare, as they called them, know, and you think, oh, that food. But then you remember that, you know, they were so much more active than us. Mm. And out walking and riding and, you know, they weren't sitting at their computers.
There's a lot of cream and everything and rich butter.
Oh, I know. I mean, I don't think it was particularly healthy. I mean, people did also drink tremendous amounts of alcohol.
Yeah.
But partly, I believe, to stay warm, you know, because it was cold and there was no central heating.
Right.
So you find a lot of sort of late night drinks and things, you know, full of alcohol and to stay warm.
Well, it is very interesting. And I wonder if vipers won't be making a comeback anytime soon. But certainly those, I guess the luxurious nature of fine dining has remained quite the same. So many of these recipes or tidbits about food throughout this book made me really interested. There's a recipe called roti soufflé. That sounds just great. And the note here is a most remarkable dish for lightness and flavor. It's written by Biddy.
Yeah, I think what I wanted to show there was it's the first time Biddy sees a souffle, so to speak, you know, because that would be such a French concept.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's very impressive looking, too. I mean, it's quite unlike anything else, texture.
You know, it's another level, isn't it?
Yeah.
Compared to, you know, a meat pie.
So, puddings.
And so, you know, she's this concept of using, you know, egg white to really lighten things. You know, I suppose someone had to invent it, didn't they?
It's very refined, and she figures out how to make it. It kind of leads her on this path. And then there's something else. There's a burnt toast recipe.
Toast tea, yes.
Burnt toast tea.
Her mistress is having stomach problems. Her mistress is pregnant. I mean, that's not such a big reveal. And I think, you know, as in, you know, the whole mythology of morning sickness, you know, that people like charcoaly coal and things like that, that there was a remedy for this rather vile thing, which involves burning toast and then using the black to make a sort of tea.
Does that work?
Well, I suspect it might have worked if because people, I mean, I've come across people taking charcoal tablets for digestion.
Ew.
I know. But, you know, I think, you know, sometimes we think, oh, that sounds sort of ghastly. But I'd say not all, but a certain proportion of their remedies probably did work.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem like it could do harm either.
No. I mean, maybe carcinogenic in large quantities. But, obviously I was on the lookout for interesting recipes. Yeah.
I mean, there's so many fascinating, just little rich details like that throughout this book that I just want to eat this book up. I know that's really cliche, but...
Oh, no, thank you. And I must say, you know, I'm very pleased with the American edition. It's got lovely...
Ooh, is it Americanized?
It's got lovely recipe, you know, borders and things. Very nice, yeah.
Well, throughout reading it, it sounded pretty British to me, the diction and so forth. So I felt like I was kind of in a vacation, different land while reading it.
That's great. That's wonderful.
Well, that's about all the time we have for today, but really, really great work. I can't wait to see what you do next. You plan on writing another novel?
Yes, I am. I'm writing a novel also about a cook, but it's darker. I was very thrilled to have the reaction that I'd started a new genre, culinary gothic.
Wonderful.
So the new one's very culinary gothic.
Wow. So in 50 or so years, we're going to be talking about Martine Bailey, the mother of culinary gothic. No, I'm sorry.
Well, So the new one's very gothic and, as I say, also about a cook.
Fantastic. I can't wait to check it out.
Thank you. Well, congrats
again, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.